As some of you will know, been looking in previous Wednesdays at what we're calling key links, that is, individuals in the New Testament who act, as it were, as links between the apostles themselves, and, as it were, the next generation of Christians who, not being apostolic and not being those who may have seen Jesus himself in the flesh, are, as it were, the first and second wave of believers who are called upon to believe and to serve on the same basis as we are. Not having seen Christ in the flesh, not being themselves apostles, but still those who are called upon to render what service they can with what the Lord has given them. Above all, who are called upon to believe, and in believing then to serve. And we looked a couple of occasions ago at Lydia in Philippi, back at Philippians again, of course, tonight, and how she was used of the Lord to make her home the base for arguably the first organized church in Europe. We looked last Wednesday at Manassen, who was the man of Cyprus, who was to be the host for Paul during his time, his last days as a free man in Jerusalem. And now things have moved on, as it were, in the narrative, and Paul is a prisoner at Rome, and from Rome he is writing to the Philippians, which, if we could say it reverently, I think it's fair to say was his favourite church amongst all the different churches to which he wrote. Certainly there is a warmth, there is an affection, there is a closeness because of their devoted love to him, which is never called in question. Other churches, they struggle with false apostles and with charlatans who are seeking to sort of displace Paul or tell them that he's not a real apostle, they should listen to them instead. Philippi, there's no hint of that. With the Philippians, it seems as if they have always trusted and believed the gospel that Paul gave to them. It seems as if they have always been, we can use the phrase, red-hot supporters of Paul and his gospel and his ministry. There's no hint of disaffection in that way amongst those in Philippi. And from this favourite church, we have the next individual in the key links that we've been looking at, as some of you will have identified, and that is Epaphroditus. Epaphroditus, who is mentioned here at verse 25 by name, and yet the remainder of the chapter, the 25 on to verse 30, is all about him and the service that he has rendered to Paul under difficult circumstances. He's mentioned again, of course, at verse 18 of chapter 4. But that's it. Like Manasseh, like Lydia, the mentions of this key link servant of Jesus are very, very limited. There's only these two verses in which he's mentioned by name, verse 25 of chapter 2 and verse 18 of chapter 4. And yet, we learn quite a bit about him from just this half dozen verses that we have here. To begin with, Paul, after saying about how he hopes to join the Philippians in due course if he is set at liberty, when he sees how things will go with him, and how he hopes to send Timothy, and he's got nobody like-minded who will naturally care for your state. But in the meantime, I supposed it necessary to send to you Epaphroditus, my brother and companion in labour and fellow soldier, but your messenger and he that ministered to my wants. He longed after you all, was full of heaviness, and so on. Now, when he goes on to say, receive him, verse 29, receive him therefore in the Lord with all gladness, hold such in reputation. Now, bear in mind that nothing with the Lord is lost. Nothing is ever for nothing. So it must be considered, under inspiration of God's Holy Spirit, it must be considered by Paul necessary to, as it were, write this to them, to encourage them to receive Epaphroditus with all gladness, to hold him in reputation, because for the work of Christ he was nigh unto death. Why would they not? Why wouldn't they be pleased to welcome back Epaphroditus, one of their own number, whom they had sent to Paul with their bounty and that which was to support Paul? The context almost certainly is that the Philippians, having known now that Paul was in prison and had been in prison for some time, though they could not go themselves and minister to him and help him and support him while he was in prison, they sent a gift to support his needs. They gathered together a collection, they sent it by the hand of one whom clearly they trusted, Epaphroditus, and one who was obviously also a brave man, because, you know, let's face it, if you're going to become, as it were, the personal servant, which is also, it's implied, what they sent him for, not just to bring the gift and say, well, there you are, that's a present from Philippi, I'm off back home again, but rather to stay in Rome and to wait upon Paul, to minister to his needs, to become almost his personal servant. If you're going to do that for somebody who is themselves a prisoner and somebody who is under suspicion or on a charge, which is at the end of the day a capital charge, you know, if Paul had been found guilty and convicted, he would have been executed. There's no question of that. He would have been executed. And therefore, somebody who is associating with one who is so tainted in the eyes of the authorities, one who is making his business to be round and about the prison or the house where Paul is a prisoner, becomes, as it were, identified as belonging to him, perhaps guilty of the same things that he, Paul, is guilty of, and runs a very real risk of being stopped or caught or questioned or perhaps flung into prison with him. There is no accounting for what might happen to somebody who chooses to associate themselves so closely with a prisoner who is under a serious charge. And this would very much be the case in Rome, a city with which Epaphroditus probably would not be that familiar. You know, it's as if somebody was in the town of London, say, and somebody who'd never been to London made their way to London so that they could visit them, so they could bring them some material support and try as best they could to be a help to them, to be a support to them. But, you know, London's a big place. Rome's a big place, capital of the known world at that time. All the problems and all the difficulties and all the dangers that a big heaving city has with it. Epaphroditus is going, in a sense, into the lion's den. And he's doing it for love of Paul on behalf of the church in Philippi. Why would they not want to receive him back? Well, it has been suggested by some that going to serve Paul in this way and then coming home again might be looked on by some as a dereliction of duty. It might be looked upon by some as though he had just quit. He was just a coward who'd run away from the trouble, from the danger. You know, we know what a dim view Paul himself took of John Mark in the Acts of the Apostles when he left Paul and Barnabas and he went back home to Jerusalem. And Paul took such a dim view of that he didn't want him back with him on a future journey. And he and Barnabas argued about it. So, you know, some people might think, well, we don't want quitters, do we? We don't want somebody who was meant to be still at his post and now he's come home. Paul is sending him home. Epaphroditus is not choosing to just give up and come home. Paul is sending him home. I supposed it necessary to send to you Epaphroditus and then receive him therefore in the Lord with all gladness and hold such in reputation. Recognize what he has done, what he's done for me, and how he has put his own life at risk and how he's fallen sick nearly unto death. And we'll come to the details of that in just a minute. But we'll see how in verse 25 here, Paul is boosting up the position, the reputation of Epaphroditus, my brother. Now, he's not even calling, he'd refer to Timothy as his son in the Lord, but my brother, he puts himself on an even rank with him, and companion in labor. So whatever I'm laboring for in the Lord, Epaphroditus is doing it too. He is, in that sense, Paul would say, my equal. And fellow soldier, this is a fight, this is a spiritual warfare. And if I'm fighting it, Epaphroditus is fighting it right alongside me. But you were messenger, and he that ministered to my wants. Now, the word messenger, to be sent with a message, or to be sent on an errand, is the word in the Greek from which we get the term apostle. An apostle is literally one who is sent. And that, in the original context, is all that it means. It means somebody being sent with a message. Jesus sent out his disciples with the message of the gospel. And because they were sent out, they were apostles. But this word that is translated, your messenger, it is literally, in the Greek, it is the term apostle. Your apostle. Now, we have this used elsewhere, of course, in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 23. Whether any do inquire of Titus, he is my partner and fellow helper, concerning you, or our brethren be inquired of, they are the messengers, literally apostles, of the churches. Now here, the English has translated it as messengers. When you get to Romans chapter 16 at verse 7, salute Andronicus and Junia, my kinsmen and my fellow prisoners, who are of note among the apostles. It's the same word, but there it's been translated as apostles, who also are in Christ before me. Now, in the Romans case, it's not quite clear whether it's just that the apostles in Jerusalem, they know about Andronicus and Junia, they are of note amongst the apostles who are in Jerusalem, or whether it means that they themselves are apostles, counted amongst the number of the proper apostles, capital A, as Barnabas was, even though he wasn't one of the 12, as Paul was, although he wasn't one of the 12. Does it mean in that sense? Or, as some have suggested, the apostles of the churches, like in 2 Corinthians 8:23, the messengers, literally apostles, of the churches and the glory of Christ, whether a distinction was made between the apostles of the churches, the messengers, the couriers, if you like, that took the messages backwards and forwards across the Roman Empire, quite a particular task, quite a skilled and a dangerous task, and one that would call forth certain qualities in people, or whether it is simply that although that is what the term literally meant, by this stage in the Christian era, the term had become specialized. It had become applicable in reality only to those of a certain rank. In other words, those who had known Christ himself or the immediate circle outside of that, including the likes of Barnabas and Paul and so on. Now, if this is the case, then we can take that Paul is using this in verse 25, your messenger, he's either saying your own apostle because you sent him, your messenger, or, as may well be the case in the original, as he is striving to build up Epaphroditus' reputation, my brother and companion in labor and fellow soldier, but you're literally apostle and he that ministered to my wants. I would suggest to you that probably in the original context here, the likelihood is that Paul is giving him the title, the status. He's an apostle if I'm an apostle. He is at my level, because everything in this verse is implying in the context Paul seeking to put Epaphroditus on his own level. He is seeking to boost up his reputation so that when he goes back, he's not going back with his tail between his legs. He's not going back as some kind of quitter or failure. He's going back with someone with this glowing testimonial from their favorite apostle, the founder of their church. And he is the one Paul describes in these terms. So I would suggest to you that I think a legitimate understanding of this term messenger in verse 25 is literally, it says, but your apostle, that he's using it in this term, my brother and companion in labor and fellow soldier, but your messenger, in other words, your apostle, he is boosting up Epaphroditus, and he that ministered to my wants. Now here's another term. The term that is translated as minister means served me, which is what ministered means. Again, the Greek word that is used here is a very particular term. It's a term which was used of not so much a servant as such, but in the original context, according to some commentators, particularly in the secular Greek world, the word is leturgon, and it means one who was of such means and substance that, for example, if there was a ship that needed to be kitted out, fully equipped for the service of the Navy, or if there was a public work that needed to be done, you know, a bridge to be built, or perhaps a regiment to be raised for the army, or to feed a whole section of the people. A citizen who would choose to do this of his own bounty, to make this, you know, magnificent contribution from his own resources to the public good. From his own resources to the public good. One who would empty himself, give of himself, give of his bounty, give of his own resources to be a benefactor, a generous benefactor and a public servant in that way, to use his own personal resources to do that which was for the public good. A benefactor, which usually only the rich and the great in a Roman city or a Greek city were in a position to do. But this is the word that Paul uses here. He that ministered to my wants, that served me, in the sense of this public-spirited servant, he uses the word to describe such a rich benefactor, as though Epaphroditus himself, from all that he had, he bestowed all this with such self-sacrificing generosity. He gave it all for Paul and for the Lord's cause. That's the sense. You see, we do struggle to understand in the English what is conveyed in the original language here. That minister to my wants, we just think, okay, well, he served him, he helped him, he ran errands for himself. No, he emptied himself, he gave everything that he had to give. Just like one of these public benefactors, these rich men who would give everything into a public work or a public benefit. And he that ministered to my wants. So in this verse 25, he has heaped praise and, not adulation, but certainly reputable compliments upon the head of Epaphroditus here. He is giving him a glowing testimonial as he sends him home. For he longed after you all, and was full of heaviness because that he had heard that he had been sick. Now, Philippi is in excess of 600 miles from Rome as the crow flies. Now, obviously you can't travel as the crow flies in those days. It is a long and tortuous journey from Philippi, first of all, to the Adriatic coast. And then when you cross the wee stretch of water, you've got another long, tortuous journey all the way up to Rome. So you're looking at best part of 700 miles of a journey, both by land and by sea. Now, this news of Epaphroditus falling sick has got to go from Rome back to Philippi, 600-700 miles. And then the fact that they know that he is sick has to come back again to Rome. So this is a huge elapse of time, a huge amount of travelling for this message to go. First from Rome, back to Philippi, and then again back from Philippi to Rome, because he had heard. He knew, because you had heard, that he had been sick. And for him to hear that you'd heard, it's got to go both ways. The message has got to go both ways. So this indicates something of how ill he must have been. He was ill for a long time. Now, there's all manner of speculation as to, you know, what might have stricken him down, whether it was a fever, whether it was plague, or whatever. It was some of the particular illnesses with which Rome was specially afflicted, with so many people living in such close confinement and no sanitation and no medical care and so on. But at any rate, he longed after you all. He was full of heaviness because that he had heard that he had been sick. Now, when it says, for indeed he was sick, nigh unto death, but God had mercy on him, and not on him only, but on me also, lest I should have sorrow upon sorrow. We might think, okay, well, Paul's an apostle. Why didn't he just heal him? You know, that's what he'd done in the past. Acts 28, verses 8 and 9 came to pass that the father of Publius, this is when in Malta, lay sick of a fever and of a bloody flux, to whom Paul entered in and prayed and laid his hands on him and healed him. So when this was done, others also which had diseases in the island came and were healed. Acts 19, verses 11 and 12, God wrought special miracles by the hands of Paul, so that from his body were brought unto the sick handkerchiefs or aprons, and the diseases departed from them, and the evil spirits went out of them. Why doesn't he just do it for Epaphroditus? If he can do it for Publius' father, then he can do it for other people who didn't even touch him, but just took aprons or handkerchiefs or whatever from him touching his body. Why didn't he do it before? Why didn't he do it again now? Well, two things I would suggest to you. One is, of course, that if Epaphroditus has fallen sick, he hasn't fallen sick in Paul's cell or in his house. If he's no longer in a position to come and minister to Paul, he must have fallen sick at his lodgings, or at least has become so severely sick at his lodgings, wherever he is staying, that he can't actually get the pill. You see, that's speculation. And maybe Paul could have, you know, touched a handkerchief against himself and taken it to Epaphroditus. Why doesn't he heal him that way? Why didn't he just pray for him at a distance and heal him that way? Well, I think there's a clue in what we read there in Acts 19. Acts 19, for example, at verse 11 and 12. God wrought special miracles by the hands of Paul, except from his body were brought unto the sick handkerchiefs and so on. Special miracles. It's not like turning off and on a tap. It is something which God didn't say, right, that's you, an apostle now. Now you have the power to heal people from sicknesses, to cast out devils, and so on. Jesus conferred that power on his own apostles when he sent them out. But even there, although perhaps they should have had the power to do it under all circumstances, when Jesus came down from the Mount of Transfiguration, remember, there they were arguing with the scribes and Pharisees about a boy who had lunatic or epilepsy or demon-possessed, however you describe it, and that they could not cast out the demon. They could not heal him. Whether through their lack of faith or insufficiently spiritually prepared, they couldn't do it. So even the ability, the power that God conferred on his apostles at particular times was not something that was their ongoing privilege and prerogative. The fact that they were able to do it under some circumstances did not mean, that they could do it anywhere and at all times. Only when the Lord gave them the particular power and ability which he would do under particular circumstances. Not unlike, if you think back to times of revivals that in the past are historically documented, you would often find, if you read into it, read the histories of them, you'll find that the Lord used a particular servant, whether a particular missionary or a particular lay preacher or a particular minister or whatever the case might have been, whether it was a special communion season, or whether it was a special evangelistic outreach, or whether it was just that people were gathered for prayer, and that's when the Spirit fell on them. Now, if the Lord used a particular individual as the sort of trigger, as the focus for such a particular revival in a particular place at a particular time, you would find that it did not follow that wherever that individual then went, and wherever he may then subsequently set up a ministry, or that revival automatically followed everywhere he went. It wouldn't. And sometimes it has been remarked upon by those who documented these things, how the Lord might use a particular person, and yet all their years of ministry beforehand had shown very little fruit. And maybe they went somewhere else after that, to a different congregation, a different parish or whatever, and nothing special happened there. It was for a set place and a set time that the Lord unlocked, as it were, the windows of heaven and poured down such blessing. I would suggest to you that that is perhaps the case with the apostolic healings and the miraculous works. They are for a particular time. They are not the prerogative of the individual. They are the gift of God to further his kingdom. You know, obviously, when Paul talks about his own thorn in the flesh, he besought the Lord thrice that that would leave him. Why couldn't he just put his hand on himself and heal himself? Because he doesn't have that kind of power all the time. God gave it to him at particular times for particular purposes. So Epaphroditus was sick, nigh unto death. But God had mercy on him, and not on him only, but on me also, lest I should have sorrow upon sorrow. I sent him, therefore, the more carefully, with the greater care, that when ye see him again, ye may rejoice, and that I may be the less sorrowful. Now, what do we understand by this sorrow upon sorrow? Well, it could mean, and that Paul is simply meaning one sorrow after another. First of all, his own imprisonment, which is a sorrow to him because it's confining and constricting him in the work he wants to do. And then if Epaphroditus was to die, that would be another sorrow upon him. But then it says in verse 28, that I may be the less sorrowful. Now, this is the only hint that we have in what is otherwise a very joyful and praise-filled letter of personal sorrow. We may be inclined to think, oh, it was all right for Paul in prison. It was adorable. Look how full of joy and look how full of exuberance his letters are. And yes, he's got problems in some churches he has to deal with. But, you know, here in Philippi, it's all just roses. It's all just easy going. And he's having such a lovely time. No, it isn't. And I think there's a clue that we might recognize in chapter 3 and verse 1. Finally, my brethren, to write the same, rejoice in the Lord. To write the same things to you, to me indeed is not grievous, but to you it is safe. And again, chapter 4, verse 4, rejoice in the Lord always, and again I say rejoice. Paul's rejoicing in prison is not, hey, isn't it brilliant, I'm in prison. Isn't it great, I'm bound with this chain, and I've got this soldier guarding me the whole time. Yeah, this is what I've always wanted all my life. No, it isn't. Nobody likes being in prison. Nobody likes being confined, particularly such a free spirit as Paul, who knows that he has a mission to the world. He wants to be out there going to all corners of the empire. He wants to be taking the good news of Jesus Christ. And here he is, stuck in Rome for 2 years and more, unable to go out. Now, of course, Paul's disadvantage is our blessing, because it's why he was in prison and wrote most of his letters. And if he'd been able to go out and about himself, he probably wouldn't have written half of these letters. But still, here he is written, and here he is confined, and we have just a glimpse that for him this incarceration is not a bundle of laughs. It is not a bed of roses. It is a sorrowful, grievous burden that he has to bear. His joy is not in his imprisonment, or in his conditions, or in the problems that he faces, or in the sickness of his friends. His joy is in the Lord. And whatever may be the outward conditions, he is always able to rejoice in the Lord. What he thinks in chapter 3 at the beginning is going to be winding down and bringing the letter to an end. Finally, my brethren, rejoice in the Lord. This is what he's saying. Then he goes on to give them lots of advice. And then he goes on again in chapter 4, rejoice in the Lord, and again I say rejoice. It is not in the things of this world that any believer has to rejoice. There's always going to be conflict, battles, spiritual warfare, so many disappointments, so many setbacks, so much to be discouraged about. Our joy is not in this world. We may have things to be encouraged about from time to time, but our joy is in the Lord. And Paul here, you just get a glimpse. The mask slips, if we can say that reverently for a moment, and we get a little hint of just how sorrowful and heavy-hearted he is being in prison and being confined and being kept in this way, that I may be the less sorrowful. God had mercy on him, and not on him only, but on me also, lest I should have sorrow upon sorrow. I send him therefore the more carefully, that when ye see him again, ye may rejoice, that I may be the less sorrowful. And then we had this bit that we looked at the beginning. Receive him therefore in the Lord with all gladness. Hold such a reputation, because for the work of Christ he was nigh unto death. And this lets us know just how serious the illness was. He was at death's door. And it says, for the work of Christ he was at death's door. And this implies that whatever it was that he was afflicted with, this illness had come upon him as a result of the work he was doing, as a result of his service, his faithfulness. It had come upon him because and in the course of his duties, of his obedience, of his faithfulness. If he'd been less faithful, maybe he wouldn't have been exposed to this particular illness. But it was for the work of Christ that he was afflicted. He was nigh unto death, not regarding his life. Now, Again, we lose a certain amount of translation. The sense of not regarding his life is in the sense of being reckless with his life. It's the sense of the gambler. It's a gambling term. He was gambling with his life, like those who stake everything on just the throw of a dice. Now, it's not the throw of a dice, obviously, it's the Lord's providence, but he was gambling everything. He was taking huge risks with his own safety, with his own health, with his own welfare. He was gambling with his life. There's a sense here in which the Greek word that's used, it came to be a term that was used of particularly sections of the church, say in times of plague or in times of natural disaster, when a couple of centuries later on, in one of the cities of the Roman Empire, plague hit the city, I think it was Carthage, and all the pagans, of course, they were just throwing out their dead and fleeing the city. And the Christian bishop, he organized his congregation together. No doubt they would have to volunteer who was going to do it. But they set themselves to tend and to nurse the sick and to bury the dead. And of course they were exposing themselves to infection. Of course they'd be exposing themselves to great danger. But this was part of the word that's used to translate here. It was almost like there were those within the church who took it upon themselves to put themselves in danger in order to serve others, in order to serve those who were seriously infected with highly contagious diseases, to serve those who were at death's door, to bury the dead for those who had died from highly infectious diseases and so on. Those who took it upon themselves to put themselves at risk, to gamble with their lives. And that became almost a term within the church of a century or so later on. Because for the work of Christ, he was nigh to death, not regarding his life, gambling with his life, to supply your lack of service toward me. Now he's not saying to the Philippians, oh, why weren't you here? Why weren't you here to support me? He knew they couldn't be. And he says in chapter 4 at verse 18, I have all and abound, I am full, having received of Epaphroditus the things which were sent from you, an odor of a sweet smell, a sacrifice acceptable, well-pleasing to God. And he knows that it has cost them to send this. And that's why the very next verse is, but my God shall supply all your need according to his riches and glory in Christ Jesus. So Epaphroditus is one who has not only hazarded his life and his safety in making this dangerous journey, he has put himself at risk in associating with the prisoner Paul, and he has clearly exposed himself to danger and to disease and has been almost snatched away into death because of his faithfulness, his obedience, his risk-taking, his hard work in the service of Christ. That is what Epaphroditus has done. And Paul gives him, in verse 25, as we see, this glowing testimonial, which is, it's all Epaphroditus gets. He's worthy of it, but it's all that he gets because he isn't mentioned anywhere else. Just this letter, just these brief few verses, and yet here we have this example of one who, but for this mention, would have remained nameless and unknown to us. Known to God, but unknown to us. You see, there are those who change the world. The likes of Paul. It's fair to say the Apostle Paul changed the world under God. The likes of Martin Luther changed the world. Others down the course of Christian history have changed the world. Epaphroditus didn't change the world. Manasseh didn't change the world. Lydia didn't change the world. But they were used of God to help and serve and work with those who did. To be a cog in the machine. To be an instrument in the Lord's hand, a paintbrush in the hand of the artist. They are used of God, these ordinary, humble, individual souls, key links between the world-changing apostles and the ordinary believers who, by their faithfulness, overspread the entire Roman Empire to the extent that eventually even the pagan emperors had to give up the persecution because the Christians were multiplying faster than the Roman emperors could execute them. It was as simple as that. Now, that multiplication is happening now today in other parts of the world where it isn't being publicly acknowledged, But in the likes of India, in the likes of Afghanistan, in the likes of Iran, the numbers of believers are multiplying and beginning to overspread these countries. Still small numbers at the moment. But the growth of the ordinary believers in the Roman Empire became exponential. And that changed the world. The ordinary individuals, like those whose names we won't know this side of eternity, and like those who linked them with the apostles, key links, like Epaphroditus, whose faithfulness we should strive to follow.